Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. We observed Labor Day earlier this week, celebrating the role of unions in this country. But organized labor has been in some decline for a long time now. Membership is well below what it was 30 years ago. That's borne out by a new study by the Economic Policy Institute. What does it mean? With us to sort that out and more is Jake Rosenfeld, Associate Professor of Sociology at Washington University. Jake, thanks so much for being with us.
It's a real pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
I hate to do this to you right at the get-go because the report is extensive, but can you give me kind of a Cliff Notes overview of the policy report?
Absolutely. So this was a report where we really targeted what the kind of dramatic decline of organized labor, especially in the private sector, has meant for the wages of specifically non-union workers. So our focus is on the vast majority of the American workforce who do not belong to a labor union and what it's meant to see the erosion of organized labor over time for their paychecks.
How dramatic has that erosion been?
In the private sector, we're talking about a peak in the mid-1950s of over one out of every three workers in the private sector was organized. To today, we're talking about 6 to 7%, so less than 10%.
That is a dramatic decline, no question about it.
Absolutely.
Why? Why the decline?
A couple of key factors here. On the one hand, the kind of story that gets oft told is one of automation and globalization, that finally, if you look at where organized labor was most strong, you look at industries like auto, and today auto faces many more competitors than it did in the past, and it just takes far fewer workers to make a car than it did 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. So that's part of the story. But, you know, we look overseas, and our kind of peer nations also face globalization and automation, and their labor movements were able to remain comparatively strong. So here the U.S. is pretty unique in terms of its dramatic decline, and that speaks to a real employer offensive that got organized and got effective starting in the 1970s onward.
Okay, let's get into that a little bit if we can. What kind of offensive are we talking about? How did that play out?
Sure. Beginning in the 1970s, employers were facing a lot of new competitive pressures and turned their sights on existing unions and kind of nascent organizing drives. And they used tactics such as threatening union organizers with termination, terminating union sympathizers at their plants, and brought in a whole new class of kind of consultants and law firms that were experts at ridding employers of existing unions and preventing new ones from forming.
And they were fairly aggressive, too, in moving to so-called right-to-work states or lobbying to make the states in which they were located right-to-work states.
Absolutely. You saw a lot of the kind of shift in manufacturing plants, not only overseas and down south to Mexico, but also to lightly organized states in the Sun Belt region in the south.
You know, we talk a lot about right-to-work, and certainly it's been a big issue in Missouri. It comes up year after year after year in the Missouri legislature. I'm not sure that, nonetheless, everybody knows what that means. Right to work seems a little bit different than what it actually means.
Sure. So right to work legislation describes efforts to, if you are a worker in an organized plant or organized workplace, in a non-right to work state, you have to pay what's called your fair share of union dues. You are not required to sign with the union. You do not have to be a union member. But you have to pay for the costs of contract negotiation, benefit negotiation, the like. In right-to-work states, you don't. You can opt out of all payments to the union, despite the fact that the union has to represent your interests when it comes time to contract negotiation.
What happens to workers in those right-to-work states in terms of earning capacity?
Sure. Right-to-work states tend to have lower average wages, higher poverty rates than non-right-to-work states. Is that due to right-to-work legislation? Here, I think the research isn't that clear. This is an issue that, frankly, my take is probably not popular on either side. It's more symbolic in many cases than substantive. We see in certain right-to-work states like Nevada, highly unionized cities like Las Vegas, where unions are really thriving. Now, right-to-work legislation absolutely does not help organized labor, but I don't think it's the death knell that many opponents and proponents think it is.
Why would unions be thriving in a place like Las Vegas or Nevada?
Yeah, I think you had some kind of really exceptional union leaders who capitalized on a disproportionately disproportionately female workforce in the retail and hospitality industries. And they formed some of the most kind of large, effective, and aggressive unions out there today and have really organized many of the hotels, casinos, and restaurants in the greater Las Vegas vicinity.
Are there any powerhouse unions left? I mean, it used to be a time when the Teamsters and AFL-CIO were pretty strong and pretty powerful.
Yeah, pockets here and there. New York City still remains a highly organized locale. You have certain unions that, unlike in the past, organize a lot of public sector unions and public sector workers, I should say. And it's important to point out that public sector membership remains much higher than private sector membership. So unions like the Service Employees International Union, which is a major body behind the Fight for 15 efforts to increase the minimum wage, they are the kind of powerhouses today.
United Auto Workers?
Not so much. The United Auto Workers, as auto, auto employment has fallen dramatically. You see United Auto Workers reaching out into whole different industries and occupations. I previously was a professor at the University of Washington, and our graduate students were actually organized by the United Auto Workers.
Well, that's a movement that's been going on here and elsewhere as well. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I think that that's an important development to watch for. There are over about a million now still unorganized adjunct professors, graduate students out there who are facing real tough times when it comes to their own paychecks and working conditions. And unions have capitalized on the cuts to higher education and have successfully organized many universities, faculty, and graduate students alike to try to kind of buttress their pay and benefit packages.
I wonder why more efforts like this aren't taking place. I mean, once we read, and we'll talk more specifically about the numbers that you have cited earlier on, but why more workers in various businesses and industries aren't seeking unionization, or are they?
Yeah, it's a great question. We know from public opinion surveys that over half of non-union workers today say they would be interested in joining a union if given the opportunity. So the desire is there. But with unionization rates so low and completely invisible in wide swaths of the country, many American workers today don't really have an understanding of what unions are, what unions do. And the kind of desire for unionization on the part of workers is oftentimes outweighed by employer opposition, that finally we see organizing drives pop up here and there, but they are quickly quashed by employers who are really skilled at keeping unions out of their workforces.
I guess it goes without saying that the employer opposition is that if you can pay workers fewer dollars, that more dollars goes to the shareholders and to the management, if you will, to the bosses.
Absolutely. And it's important to point out here that as unionization has fallen so dramatically, the costs of being the only union plant in a broader industry that's widely non-union go up because all of a sudden you're the only one out there paying a union wage premium. You're the only one out there offering union negotiated benefits. So when unions were much stronger and many workers, union and non-union alike, enjoyed union negotiated pay packages, the cost and benefit analysis from your typical employer is going to be different.
St. Louis used to be known as a union town. You know, we mentioned United Auto Workers had a large presence here at one time. Teamsters, very, very big here, and other unions as well. We can't call St. Louis a union town anymore, can we?
No, I don't think you can. There are a few left. Missouri, more broadly, has about an average unionization rate. There still remain pockets of strength in construction. And then you're starting to see some revitalization in education and some of the other industries that organize public sector workers.
Education seems to be one of the biggies in the country today. Teachers seem to be organized almost all across the country.
That's right, although there are certain states where public sector workers are not allowed to organize. And so you see a dramatic variation across state in terms of public sector unionization rates. But teachers, nurses, some of those occupations remain the kind of bulwark of today's labor movement, much different from half a century ago.
And the public sector workers, union workers, have another threat that's there, and we're seeing it in places like Illinois, and that is pensions. where the governments don't have enough money to fulfill pension obligations.
Absolutely. And so I think that's the looming crisis that states like Illinois are, you know, struggling to grapple with as we sit here and speak. And a lot of unions kind of put off immediate raises for more generous pension packages in negotiations in the past. And so they are, of course, deeply worried about what's to come.
Are unions facing extinction?
That's a tough question. I think that it's hard to imagine an advanced industrial economy such as ours without some organized worker presence. Does that mean that the union movement of tomorrow will look like the one of yesterday? Absolutely not. I think that the smart unions today, the growing unions today, are ones that recognize a very changing landscape out there and are taking advantage of it.
What about union leadership? In days past, we can remember some of the names that were popular, Walter Reuther, Jimmy Hoffa, people like that. These were powerful guys. They carried big sticks. What about today?
Yes, absolutely. Less powerful and with less clout on Capitol Hill. I think we've seen that for some time now. That said, there are some incredibly creative and innovative union leaders out there. The Fight for 15, which began, people kind of forget this, as a very small union organizing drive in the town of SeaTac, Washington, has spread across the country and is delivering substantial wage gains to millions and millions of largely non-union workers. It's the brainchild of union leaders, including a really innovative one in Seattle.
Are the union leaders of today the three-piece suit guys carrying briefcases as opposed to some of the people that I've mentioned that we know from the past?
Another good question. There's a lot of variation in the leadership ranks because there's a lot of variation among unions in the U.S. today. So you have unions organizing pipe fitters, you have unions organizing prison guards, and unions organizing nurses, and you can imagine that their leaders are going to vary along numerous dimensions.
You know, it's funny how things change. When I left Baltimore years ago, the Teamsters, of all people, were organizing court reporters. And I don't mean journalists. I mean the people who worked the machine, the stenographers who took down courtroom testimony. Didn't seem like a particularly good fit in those days. But I think they were successful.
Yeah. And I think you see the Teamsters and other unions that their traditional base is eroding, moving into these new fast-growing occupations. The Teamsters in the Pacific Northwest have successfully signed up some Uber drivers, actually, in recent years.
So they haven't really lost the willingness and the ambition to get as many members as they have. They're looking everywhere they can.
Absolutely. But it's an incredibly credible uphill battle.
Yeah. We have to take a break. We'll do that now. I'm talking with Jake Rosenfeld. He is an associate professor of sociology at Washington University. And we're talking about the Economic Policy Institute report on unions and where they stand today and how what they are making in terms of wages or not making reflects on the rest of society. We'll get into specifics there in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Jake, tell me something about the Economic Policy Institute. This is considered a fairly liberal organization. Why did it get into this study?
Sure. This is Economic Policy Institute, or EPI, commissioned this study from myself and my co-authors, Patrick Denise and Jennifer Laird, a couple of years ago now, after I had put out a book titled What Unions No Longer Do, in which a small section of it I really kind of zeroed in on what union decline is meant for non-union workers. And the Economic Policy Institute was intrigued by that and really wanted a more kind of full-throated, broad analysis of that particular question, union decline's impact on non-union workers' wages.
Give me a specific sense of how that what that impact has been.
Sure. So we calculate that looking from 1979, the late 1970s, to today, if unions remained as strong as they were in 1979, wages for private sector non-union men would be about 5% higher. But the wage effects are much larger once you drill down and look at private sector men, especially those without a college degree, and especially those with no college experience.
One of the figures that I have seen, which is staggering, is $133 billion.
That's right. In annual wages lost for private sector men without a four-year college degree. We're talking about well over $100 billion lost per year in wages. As a result, our calculations indicate of labor union decline.
Just to be clear, you're saying that the reason for this is because unions aren't around anymore in the force that they once were.
That's right. It's important. We have to add our caveats. And here, you know, there are a lot of things happening over the last couple of decades that have also kind of eroded the economic standing of especially private sector workers without a four-year college degree, including globalization, including automation. We take great pains to try to differentiate those effects from our union findings. But that said, you know, these broader forces are interrelated in very complex ways.
What has the decline of unions and union membership done to the middle class?
It's a great question. I think we saw for the couple of decades following World War II, general productivity gains in the economy were matched by steadily rising wages for your middle class family. That relationship changed right at about the time organized labor began its free fall. I would argue that organized labor was a key driver of the growth of the post-World War II middle class, specifically for those workers who didn't have advanced degrees, didn't have four-year college degrees. These days, lacking a college degree, it's very hard to land a middle-class job that's stable, that has good benefits, and that has some opportunity for advancement. In the past, it wasn't so much. And in the past, we know that many of these industries and occupations were organized.
And we're suffering other problems as a result of this, obviously. I think crime would have to fit in there, poverty and the issues that that generates, including crime and other things as well.
Yes, I think that that's absolutely right. Once you have economic stagnation, and economic stagnation for a wide a group of U.S. workers, you see all sorts of kind of ancillary negative effects that are playing out today.
Okay, we have some listeners who want to get into the conversation. Let's allow them to do that. Before I go to the phones, I'll take an email from Madonna, and I think this will just reinforce the question. Your answer will reinforce this. Is there any evidence that overall wages are higher for everyone in areas where union membership is strong? Is there really a rising tide lifts all boats effect where all wages are indexed off of union wage levels? You're saying, I guess, that yes, in fact, that is the case.
That's absolutely the case. With the exception of research that's been done hasn't found much of a linkage between union presence and top upper-level CEO pay. So unions generally provide benefits for union members and for other like occupations out there. What there hasn't been found is much relationship between union density and upper-level management.
You may not have the answer to this question. It may be unfair, but I've forgotten exactly the number, but the executives, the men and women in the executive suite made 150 times, I'll use that number, 150 times what the average worker makes in terms of salary. Whatever it is, how different is it now than it was, let's say, in 1950?
It's dramatically different. The recent estimates, actually from another Economic Policy Institute report, have it more pegged at more 300 to 350 to 1. And that's up an order of magnitude from what it was in the 1960s, 1950s, where top-level executives, for a variety of reasons, just weren't enjoying at these incredibly high salaries that they are now.
Much less than 350%.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay, let's go to the phones. We'll bring in Dennis calling from Overland. Dennis, go ahead. You're on the air with Jake Rosenfeld.
Okay, thank you, Don. I wanted to point out that years ago in the heavily unionized states, and usually taxes were higher, and more money went into the federal government and less of that money went back to the states when we were the United States. But a lot of that money went down to building the South, the infrastructure and the highways and everything. And now, over the last 20 or 30 years, these states still keep their taxes low, but they use their money to drag a lot of the businesses down there. Secondly, I think if the minimum wage was hooked up to the COLA, and so that when retirees get a little raise, the minimum wage goes with it, we would not have to have this battle for the long haul. Last thing, and I'll leave it go, my daughter lives in Mexico, and every time there's an election, because they do not have civil service unions, everything stops for about 3 or 4 months until things, maybe even more. So the stability that goes on in your government in a lot of these places, because people are protected from losing their jobs because of an election, is invaluable. And thank you for the show.
Thanks, Dennis. Lost or two on there, Jake.
Sure. Let me take up the question of the minimum wage and it's why it's not adjusted for inflation today. Minimum wage increases on Capitol Hill used to be so popular that both parties decided not to index them for inflation because they saw that they would be rewarded by the electorate by increasing them every year through separate pieces of legislation. That's changed pretty dramatically today, where the federal minimum wage has remained stuck for some time at well below a sustainable wage, let alone poverty level wages.
Right. Okay. Well, let's take Brian's call from St. Louis. Brian, go ahead. Brian, are you there? One more chance, Brian. Turn down your radio if you hear me. Okay. I guess Brian is... has bailed out. We have a tweet here from Matthew referring to polling that half of non-union workers say they would join a union if given the opportunity. Would these data differ by industry, do you think? I mean, you know, examples here, deli workers versus college faculty, for instance.
Yeah, I think that's a fascinating question. I suspect they would. We know that unions in support for unions and support for kind of unionization drives at your own workplace tend to be higher for manual occupations and tend to be a bit lower for the professions. That said, these days it's actually easier to organize in many professions such as college faculty than it is to organize deli workers in many cases. So we've got a growing mismatch between the desire for unionization on the part of workers and the ability to actually see that through.
The Policy Institute's report and our discussion is focused pretty much on money. But there's another thing that comes along with union membership and association, that is working conditions, not necessarily having to do with dollars and cents per se. Have these changed? Did you get into that in your study?
Not in this particular study, but we know from certain industries what happens when there isn't an organized worker presence there any longer. You look at meatpacking. Meatpacking was incredibly dangerous, also had low pay, but horrible working conditions. For a couple of decades there, it became organized. It still was not the world's most enjoyable job, but safety rates improved, safety records improved, injuries went down. And then today, as unions have been run out of the industry, it's once again an incredibly dangerous occupation.
All right. So where do we go from here? Does the Economic Policy Institute have recommendations for us?
They do. Again, with kind of paralysis on Capitol Hill, it's hard to see any federal level piece of legislation that will really help organize labor, balance the playing field a bit coming in the near future. The last big push was in 2008. Organized labor's signature piece of legislation, the Employee Free Choice Act, couldn't overcome Senate opposition and then died in the summer of 2009 and then with the midterm elections of 2010 wasn't heard from again. What we have instead now are state-level efforts and municipal-level efforts kind of on the margins to help out organized labor and organized labor's allies. And so that's probably what we can, what labor's allies can hope for in the near future.
You know, it used to be that unions had significant political clout and they were courted by politicians at all levels. Does that still exist?
Not nearly to the degree. In the past, unions enjoyed significant Republican support, oftentimes not because the Republicans actually believed in the unions to support them, but they're too scared to cross them. And that speaks to organized labor's really past political prowess. Today, that's declined. Unions still bring out the vote, but they do so on a much smaller basis. They still provide a lot of money to politics and politicians and organize and elections at various levels, but not to the degree that they once were able to.
Therefore, the legislation for, you know, positive for unions is not really happening. Right. I'm going to take one more call before we have to say goodbye. Nick has been waiting. He's calling from Chicago. So, Nick, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me. My name is Nick. I'm a spokesperson for SAU Local 1. And I just want to call in because earlier you outlined some of the more, the ways that unions are attempting to expand their membership, right? And in St. Louis, obviously, I'm sure you're very much aware of adjunct faculty organizing on their campuses at Washington University, St. Louis University, St. Louis Community College, you know, really looking at new classes of workers and seeing how we can lift up different people across the economic spectrum, right? Because I think a lot of people don't always understand that people like airport workers or people like adjunct professors, they also need to fight for $15. They also need a boost.
Nick, so thanks. Thank you for the call. I'm interrupting because time's getting in the way, but we had to address that somewhat earlier on. Anything you need to add to that, Jake?
I think that's absolutely right. And what's important to also keep in mind related to Nick's point is all the efforts organized labor are putting in to improve wages and working conditions for workers today who are non-union. These are efforts like the Fight for 15, pressure on fast food chains and the like that haven't translated into new union workers but have significantly improved the working conditions for millions of low-wage workers out there.
People should really take a look at the unions and what has happened over the years and what has happened to the middle class as a result of the union's decline. Jake Rosenthal, thank you so much for being with us. Jake is an associate professor of sociology at Washington University. It's fascinating stuff. It's been a big part of our history, and you have to wonder where it's going to go from here, Jake.
Absolutely. Well, thanks so much for having me on.
This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.